Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. After today's interview, you may want to step away from your computer. Today, identity theft is a commonplace worry, but most of us have a rather naive view of where that threat comes from. Well, my guest today has written a rather chilling account of our personal, business, and governmental vulnerability to data theft, privacy violation, and computer crime. Today's hacker more closely resembles a multinational corporation than a criminal gang or an individual in a basement computing room. And in some cases, legitimate technology companies are unwittingly or occasionally knowingly aiding and abetting these efforts to violate privacy, steal data, and money. Today, cybercrime is expanding at an exponential rate, and law enforcement consultant Mark Goodman documents cases from a single hacked account to cases of criminals robbing upwards of 100 million people at a single time. The threat to computerized systems, from sewage treatments to oil gas pipelines, the electric grid or air traffic control systems, or your car. He also looks at how government hacking from China, Russia, Iran, and Western democracies simply offer more ways for criminals to adapt those technologies and boomerang them against us. His new book is titled Future Crimes: Everyone is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. It's published by Doubleday. Mark Goodman has been a longtime law enforcement and technology consultant. He's appointed as a futurist in residence with the FBI, worked as a senior advisor to Interpol. He's the founder of the Future Crimes Institute and chair for policy, law, and ethics at Silicon Valley's Singularity University. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Mark Goodman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
The pleasure is mine, Rich.
I have to tell you, this book scared the bejesus out of me. Future Crimes. It begins with a story of probably the average person's worst fear about getting hacked on the internet, and that is the story of Matt Honan. And from there, it gets progressively worse. Yet you say you're an optimist.
I try to be. Yeah, you're right. Future Crimes starts off with Matt Honan, who was a reporter for Wired magazine, and a hacker selected him just to basically pick on because of his position and his email address and Twitter handle, and he went after him. And he was able to get into all of Matt's accounts. Matt was sitting at home playing with his two-year-old daughter, bouncing her off his knee, and suddenly he saw his iPhone power down. And he thought, wow, that's strange. And when it came back on, rather than seeing the phone, he saw the white apples that said, please register your phone. So he went to his iPad, and he saw the same thing happening. And then he went to his laptop, and he saw the same thing happening. And it turns out somebody had hacked his accounts and was remotely wiping all of his devices. And
wow.
They were able to delete 8 years of his Gmail that were completely gone, all the photographs of his brand-new baby daughter from the time she was born until the time she was 2 years old, and even photographs of long-lost relatives that could never be recovered. So we store all of this information online and hope and pray that it will still be there. But the fact of the matter is, if somebody chooses to wipe it out or get rid of it, they can do that.
In this case, Matt decided to get at the heart, and so he actually somehow figured out who did this. It was a hacker named Phobia. And what is actually more chilling about it was that he didn't have a beef with Matt. He liked his Twitter handle.
That's right. Matt had a rare, because he was an early adopter of Twitter, he had a rare three-letter Twitter handle, at Matt, M-A-T. And that's what the hacker decided. So for no other reason that he liked his Twitter handle, kind of like a bully, he could reach out there and take what he wanted. He deleted all those accounts and did it.
And there was no way of getting that information back?
You know, Matt Honan told his personal story in a cover article for Wired magazine. And he spent thousands and thousands of dollars going ahead and having his computer forensically examined, trying to recover some of that data, of which he was able to get a very small part back.
Wow. The next work looks at systems attacks. And I think this is something most people fear, you know, attacks on the electric grid, everything from oil pipelines to sewage treatment. And we think of it in the future tense. We worry about it in the future. But what you make clear is there have been many attacks on a small scale around the world. Give us a sense of where system attacks have happened.
Sure, of course. Well, you know, when we think of computers, we often will think of our own laptops, our computers at home or in the office, or even our smartphones. But there's a whole other set of computers, and these computers, in effect, run the world. And those are sort of industrial control systems that run the electrical grid, that run sewage treatment facilities, the financial markets, ATMs, hospital equipment and electronic medical records, 911 dispatch. They are all controlled by computers. And unfortunately, these computers, just like all other computers, can be hacked and can go ahead and we can have failures of them. And there have been several examples that I talked about in Future Crimes. One was an attack against a airport in Worcester, Massachusetts, where a hacker had a plane coming in for landing at nighttime, and he was able to remotely disable the landing lights there. There was another attack that occurred by a disgruntled insider who kept his laptop after he was fired from a company in Australia and was able to hack into the sewage treatment facility and basically reverse the sewage flow process so that he leaked raw sewage out onto the streets of Queensland, Australia. They had to do evacuations of a Hyatt hotel and a particular neighborhood. And there have also been hacks against the electrical grid. An organized crime group in Brazil held a city of 1 million people hostage and said to city officials that if they didn't pay a ransom, that the criminals would turn off the electrical grid. And they did just that. So all of these systems are connected. They're all vulnerable to attack. And we really need to get serious about doing something about it.
Now, how serious is law enforcement taking this? You tell the story in the book about how you got into the electronic sides of it as a police officer when somebody said, hey, do you know how to work spell check?
Yeah, that's true. Back in the day, that was the skill. I was working with the Los Angeles Police Department. My lieutenant in the detective squad room screamed my name, Goodman, get your butt over here. And I thought I was in trouble. And he asked me, hey, I got a question. Do you know how to spell check in WordPerfect? And I said, sure, boss. Shift F2. And then he smiled a big smile and said, okay, good. I knew you were a computer geek. I got a case for you. So the fact that I knew how to spell check, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, kind of put me at the techno elite of policing. And I've just stuck with it ever since. But the fact of the matter is it's difficult for law enforcement. In a sense, the internet broke policing. Why? In the old days, if you had a bank robbery in downtown Tulsa, you knew who was responsible for investigating it. You knew it'd be either the Tulsa police, the state police, or the FBI, and you knew that your criminal was local to the bank. You knew that that criminal may have gone ahead and left evidence behind in photographs or DNA on the counter, fingerprints, all of those telltale signs that would have helped cops investigate cases in the past. But now that crime can be just as easily committed by somebody in Moscow or Kiev or Lagos, Nigeria. And so the Tulsa police have few, if any, resources that they can reach out and touch somebody halfway around the world. So our internet has made it possible for criminals anywhere in the world to reach out and touch you in particular, and we have very few resources to be able to go back the other way.
I was going to say, how specialized are the computerized policing on the federal level, but on the state and local level? I would think it would be very difficult to staff up.
It's difficult not just because of the technical means, right? It's very easy to hide your tracks when you are a cyber criminal. So if you think about those old movies where we see somebody, you know, calling up the FBI and they route their call through all these different cities to make the call difficult to trace, the same is true with internet criminals. They can go ahead and route their traffic through 10 or 20 different hops around the world each time, you know, lying about where they are. So they pretend to be in Brazil or South Korea. And by the time you figure out where they actually are, a good chunk of time has gone by. And in order to figure out that they were lying, you need to reach out to the police in every single city to know whether or not they were actually there. So, for example, if you're investigating a crime in the United States and it looks like the hacker's coming from Brazil, first step is you reach out to the police in Brazil, and eventually they'll say, no, no, this didn't originate in Brazil. It actually originated in Seoul, South Korea. And then you reach out to them, and they say, no, our systems were hacked. It actually started out in Pretoria, South Africa. And you keep on pulling on that thread, but the challenge is that it takes weeks and months to get access to that data. And, of course, the bad guys can change their IP address in a matter of seconds.
Now, I think most people have a very simplified notion of who the hackers are. We think of them as, you know, the nerd in the basement that has sort of got his own little command center there. And it's certainly a popular vision from movies, but hackers are completely organized, and in some ways they resemble corporations, but criminal corporations.
Well, that's exactly right, Rich. One of the things I discuss in Future Crimes is that exact notion. Some of your listeners may remember the old movie War Games, where you have that 17-year-old nerdy kid, you know, who's the computer genius. But more and more, we're seeing standard organized criminals stepping into the world of cybercrime. Today, it is more than 85% of criminal hackers are affiliated with an organized crime group. So these are not one-off lone wolves mostly in their basements. This is part of an international organized crime effort and ring. And those 17-year-old kids, they've grown up. According to a study by the RAND Institute, the average age of a cyber criminal is 35. So this is a business, and it's big business. And some of these businesses are doing $500 million, $1.2 billion. There was a case that your listeners may be familiar with called the Silk Road, where a guy was selling drugs online in the digital underground. And according to FBI research, that one site selling drugs in the digital underground, of course, they also sold illegal firearms, child pornography, stolen driver's licenses, credit cards. They did $1.2 billion worth of business in just 2.5 years.
Now, in that case, in the Silk Road, for those who are unfamiliar, it is a dark side of the internet where lots of encryption, lots of safeguards to protect identities, and it's where virtually anything illegal can be bought and sold. And the guy who did this was a guy who went by the handle Dread Pirate Roberts. Tell us a little about this story, because this is one of the better success stories in combating this.
It is, absolutely, although it took a long time to sort out from the police side. So Dread Pirate Roberts, a.k.a. Ross Ulbricht, was a young man living in San Francisco. Nice, you know, upstanding kid, so it seemed. He was an Eagle Scout. He went to the University of Texas. He got a master's degree in engineering, I believe it was, at Carnegie Mellon University. And from his laptop, he ran this massive drug empire. I can say that he ran it because he's now just been convicted about a month ago, so the FBI was able to prove its case. But he was running his drug empire, in effect. It's kind of like eBay for crime. So you could go to this website and put in everything from stolen passports, stolen identity, American Express cards, you know, child pornography, AK-47, whatever it is you were looking for, methamphetamine, and you would see it all show up right there. In order to access the Silk Road, people needed special software, and that software was called Tor, or the Onion Router, and it's a freely available program. You could download it, and once you accessed Tor and ran this program on your computer, you would now have access to go into this deep web. Most folks spend their time on what we call the surface web. They hang out on eBay, they do some Googling, they may go to ESPN, Twitter, Facebook, their bank, whatever it may be. But there's a whole other internet, the deep web. This is the part of the internet that Google does not index. It's the part of the internet that's hidden behind firewalls and passwords and needs special encryption like Tor to access. And there, you'll see a whole other world that's actually larger than the surface internet. Most people might not realize it, but when they're searching Google, they're searching a very small part of the available information in digital format. Google only indexes 16% of the surface web, according to a study in Nature, and they access and index 0% of this deep web. So when you're doing a Google search, you're actually only having access to 0.03% of the digital information available out there. But if you know where to look and if you have the right tools, you can find anything you want, including a whole bunch of illicit stuff.
My guest today is Mark Goodman, a futurist in residence with the FBI. He's a senior advisor to Interpol, a police officer, and the author of Future Crimes. Everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable, and what we can do about it. It's published by Doubleday. And this gets to the heart of the difficulty in policing the web. Very early in the book, you use an illustration of exponential growth, which is French school children being taught about a lily that's going to cover a pond in 30 days, and it will kill everything. But the whole thing is the lily starts day 1 through 10, it's minuscule. Day 10 through 15, it's still minuscule. It's only in the last few days, day 29, when it covers half the pond, the next day it covers the complete pond, that we see the sort of that it's an exercise in seeing how exponential growth goes. And as you write in the book, we're pretty much at day 29 at this point. We're growing, we're what, 2 to 3 billion people are now using the internet?
That's right. So in this book, Future Crimes, I explain why these challenges are growing and why they're growing so quickly. You know, the old paradigms of crime are being broken by technology. Technology follows what's called Moore's Law. It was named after Gordon Moore, who was the founder of the Intel computer chip company. And what he said is that the price performance of computing doubles every 18 to 24 months, which is why the iPhone that most people carry around in their pockets today has more computer processing power on it than was available to all of NASA during the Apollo 11 space launch, right? That's how powerful that mobile phone is, that smartphone in your pocket. And so every 18 to 24 months, it's doubling and doubling. And it's very difficult for most folks to get their head around what exponential means, because we don't think like that. We think linearly. You know, if I take 30 steps linearly, meaning one right after the other, I might get, you know, from my living room to the front door of my house. But if I take 30 steps exponentially, doubling the distance that I cover every time, I don't get to the front door of my house. I get all the way to the moon. That is the power of exponentials. And so we have our technologies that are doubling and doubling and doubling all the time. And the challenge is for police, law enforcement is not an exponential technology. Public policy is not exponential. And surely our Congress is not an exponential institution. So you have linear versus exponential. And just think about everybody, you know, it's like you're running a foot race, but you're completely handicapped. So we need to build much better systems to be able to deal with some of these threats, because the bad guys are running ahead. And the old tools that worked for, you know, centuries are now being broken, such as international law enforcement, policing. Used to work pretty well for a few hundred years, but now that these crimes can be committed from anywhere, the system is sort of breaking. And, of course, the bad guys are growing exponentially. That's why when we think of the Target hack, as you may be aware, you know, in that instance, there were over 100 million accounts compromised. The bad guys have gone from robbing one-on-one, right? You think about a bad guy hiding in a dark alley with a gun. That was a one-on-one affair. But now, using computers, you can reach out and touch more people. And those attacks can be scripted to run 24/7 in the background via computer algorithms and artificial intelligence, which makes it possible to reach out and break into 100 million accounts. Never before in the history of humanity has it been possible to steal 100 million of anything, let alone rob 100 million people simultaneously. So we've seen exponential growth in crime, but we've not seen exponential growth in our defenses and in law enforcement. And this is a problem that we're going to have to fix, and that's one of the central points that I make in Future Crimes.
But governments are involved in some of their best and brightest are working at not only trying to prevent things, but they're also snooping into other people. I mean, Edward Snowden's account shows that we're doing it. The governments of Iran, most governments, I would think, have hackers that are probing other governments and also sometimes businesses. And what really was frightening to me is anything that's created by a government agency, whether it's in China or Russia, can be grabbed by criminals and adapted.
That's exactly right. So you point out the dual nature of this technology, which is the government may not be doing a great job on defense, but they seem, according to those accounts that you referenced, to be doing an awful good job on offense. And what we have is, in our government, and particularly within the NSA, what most people don't realize is that the NSA has two hats. Most folks will be familiar with their offensive mission, which is to go after national security information contained in computers overseas, and as Mr. Snowden has alleged, sometimes even here in the United States. But the NSA has another critical mission, which is to go ahead and protect and defend the national computers and infrastructure of the United States government and its people. And on that mission, they tend to do much, much worse. And in fact, there is a bit of a schizophrenia within the NSA, because those that are doing the offensive mission want to make sure that all the computer backdoors that they know about are not plugged, that all the leaks are not plugged, because this way they have a way of breaking into foreign systems overseas. The challenge is that if they know about the backdoors, probably so do other governments, and certainly do criminals. And so even though the NSA might tell people in America, or might tell a local power plant in Tulsa or San Francisco, hey, you should fix this hole, they don't want that plugged for an equivalent overseas. So they keep that information to themselves. They have these internal debates, and it seems, at least overtly, that the debates are always won by offense, which is why we have such bad defense in cyberspace.
Well, let me ask you about another fairly familiar story, which was the story of the Stuxnet worm, which, wherever it came from, it did tremendous damage in Iran in their uranium enrichment. And what's really scary about this is that the way it worked, it just seems like it could be adapted and used against the United States, because what this worm did was it shifted the amount of power and the amount of it fluctuated the centrifuges to ruin the uranium, ruin the centrifuges themselves, and yet it was created so the technicians saw nothing amiss. It was, you know, I'm just thinking of a nuclear power plant that's, you know, being attacked in a way like this, where all the monitors look good, yet the actual situation is falling apart.
Yeah, so I wrote about the Stuxnet attack in Future Crimes and put it in a chapter called In Screen We Trust, right? The old motto on our money was In God We Trust. But now it's kind of been replaced with In Screen We Trust. Most people believe all the information that they see on their computers. If you get a text message and it says it's from your mom, you believe it's from your mom. If you go ahead and try to order something on Amazon and it says it's out of stock, then you believe it's out of stock. But all of that information can be hacked. And you were talking about the Iranian nuclear power facility at Natanz. The U.S. government, Israelis, and others believe that they were producing, the Iranians were producing nuclear weapons there. The Iranians said, of course, that they were just doing peaceful nuclear power for their own people. And so, mysteriously, that power plant was hacked, and the uranium centrifuges were attacked, such as you pointed out, that they spun out of control and could not effectively refine uranium required either for nuclear energy or a nuclear bomb. And what was interesting about that is that as the nuclear engineers in Natanz looked at their screens, on the screen, everything looked fine. You know, all systems were go, all the lights were green. But in reality, those centrifuges were spinning out of control because the malware that got into their system went ahead and changed what was actually happening, what was shown on the screen. So the challenge is for us as a people and as a society is we are increasingly living our lives intermediated by screens. If the GPS tells you to go right, you go right. If you try to send a message or get an email, you believe what you see. If your bank balance says it's $500 or $1,000, you believe it. Because all of that information is on screens, though, they can be hacked. All screens do is show the underlying information that's in a computer. You know, people worry about their information being stolen. But in a sense, having your data stolen might be the best of all scenarios. What could be much worse is having your data changed. So you can imagine a patient going into the hospital and they're supposed to have their right leg amputated, or they're supposed to get AB negative blood and instead they get a different type. All of that data is just on screens and it's all hackable. So this In Screen We Trust mentality is a big problem, and it underlies a much bigger challenge, which is that in today's world, there really is no such thing as trustworthy computing. We have no way of verifying the data that we see on our screens, and bad guys or bad governments or even terrorists can take advantage of this data and use it against us. And so I call for the need for more trustworthy computing out there.
And I tell you, the other thing is even upstanding corporations, the idea there is no privacy anywhere in cyberspace, despite the fact that we'll get updated privacy guides that are come to us on a regular basis. Your book makes clear that Google, data brokers of all types, are mining your data constantly, and not just data mining for general characteristics. They're looking at specifically an individual as they're doing this. That was somewhat chilling to me.
Well, Rich, a lot of us are using these social media services, whether they be Facebook or LinkedIn or others. And, you know, we think that we are Facebook's customer. But the fact of the matter is, I ask people all the time, how much do you pay for Facebook? And they say nothing. I said, well, then why do you think you're their customer? If you go into Starbucks, they don't give you free coffee. If you go into McDonald's, you don't get a free quarter pounder, and you don't get free clothes at Macy's, right? So if you're not paying for something, there's a good chance you're not the customer, you're actually the product. And that is the bargain that folks are making, is they're sharing all of this data with Facebook. They get this really fun and amazing social media service that, you know, 1.3 billion people on our planet love to use every day. But they're taking your data and they're selling it to their true customers, which are advertisers. And they're slicing and dicing your readers into groups and subgroups and subgroups so that they can be targeted. And as long as folks understand that's the bargain they're making, then I'm perfectly fine with it. But what they tend to do, these companies, is they put out these terms of service that are incomprehensible and I think should be called terms of abuse. Because if you ever read all 10, 20, 30,000 words, you would see all the different things they could do with your information. These terms of service, Facebook started out at 1,000 words and has now grown to 9,000 words. By comparison, the U.S. Constitution is only 4,400 words. And PayPal has the largest terms of service in the industry at 36,000 words. Shakespeare's Hamlet, only 32,000 words. So if most people read each one of those terms of service that they confronted every day, it would take them 78 days a year, full time of their life, to read all of these terms of service. So when somebody needs to use 30,000 words to explain how you are their customer and how they're helping you, it's pretty clear those 30,000 words weren't written to benefit you.
You did look at Google Docs, and you use an example in the book, but if you had written this book in Google Docs, according to the terms of service, they could have owned the book.
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, was surprising to me as I went through it. But if you look at some of those terms, and you mentioned Google, right, if you go ahead and use Gmail, or even if you don't use Gmail and you email somebody who is on Gmail, Google asserts the right to take what you say, to read through it, you know, via machine learning and reading, and show you advertisements based upon that. And they say that they own the data that is in their system. So if you do use Google Docs to write a book or a play, then Google claims for itself the right to use it, repurpose it, translate it in this medium, any medium to be discovered in the future, that they can perform it, that they assert dramatic rights and the like. So, yes, you need to read what you're signing up for very carefully. Again, this doesn't mean that these are bad services or bad people. It's just that folks have to know what they're getting into.
Well, let's leave folks with a few practical tips, and your practical tips in the appendix. You know, a few years ago, somebody would have read that chapter and said, is this guy wearing tinfoil? But in fact, it starts with common sense, and it gets increasingly, you know, if you have a camera, keep it covered up when you're not using it, because somebody can hack in and look through your camera on your phone.
Well, the fact of the matter is that there are cameras all over the place. In Future Crimes, I tell the story of Cassidy Wolf, who was Miss Teen America. And she had her camera hacked. She was sitting at her computer one day. She got an email of about 20 or 30 different photos of herself naked in her own bedroom. And there was a demand note attached to the email that said, I have all these photos. I'm going to release them on Facebook and put them on the internet unless you have sex with me online, you know, on video chat. Ugh. And she freaked out, of course. She called her mom, who thankfully called the FBI. When they investigated it, they found out it was one of her classmates who hacked her camera. She kept her laptop open in her bedroom, and as she came out of the shower, that camera was hacked and was taking pictures of her. And despite what you might think, you know, they were able to turn off the little green light or the little red light so it never looked like the camera was recording. All of that can be controlled. It's in Screen We Trust. So she realized that. But the good news is that that is a very simple thing you can do. Just take a yellow sticky and put it over your camera on your laptop. And while that may seem excessive to some, it's a pretty simple step that you can take to avoid that problem. And the same is true in the office with all of your computers there. Your competitors could be hacking into through industrial espionage. So in Future Crimes, I have six different steps that people can take. It's called the Update Protocol, UPDATE. Each one of those letters stands for a really simple tip that you can take to reduce your cyber risk online. If you go to my website, futurecrimes.com, and sign up there, I'll be happy to send your listeners an infographic with all those tips they can use to protect themselves.
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
Mark Goodman is a law enforcement consultant and the author of Future Crimes, published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.